Tonight, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. And this week, we're looking at the changing economics of the car. Australia is a car country. Last year, we bought 1.18 million new cars, and we spent $78.4 billion a year on them. Jane Speechley writes for Practical Motoring.
The car industry in Australia is one that's undergone an extraordinary transformation in the past few years. We are a nation of car lovers. We love our cars and we love to drive. So I think around 16.5 million Australians drive a car, and we're looking at probably almost 19 million vehicles registered in Australia. So we do love to drive.
We do. And at the moment, we love to drive large vehicles. The top two selling cars are actually big utes, the Toyota Hilux and the Ford Ranger. Then there's a few little cars, the Toyota Corolla, the Hyundai i30, the Mazda 3, before we bump back up to an SUV.
Anyone will tell you on the roads there are a lot of SUVs around, and the reasoning behind that is quite interesting. I think I'll refer to my good friend Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute here when he says that the more we spend our time, you know, locked in gridlocked traffic and on those long daily commutes, the more we dream of the freedom that vehicles can give us. And so you see an emerging number of four-wheel drives with people with great aspirations of getting off-road on the weekends, and of course the sports cars where people can kind of let their hair flow free, so to speak.
Car purchases are made on cost, equipment, safety rating, and emotion. So how do we think about and use cars in Australia today? Travis Waller is director of the Research Centre for Integrated Traffic Innovation at the University of New South Wales.
I think the tricky thing is it's evolving very rapidly, and it's evolving under our nose, and we're starting to get some insights into that, but no one knows absolutely for sure. For instance, in a survey that was done, 22% of adults in Sydney indicated that they had used car share services in the past 6 months, like GoGet. 37% indicated that they'd used rideshare, like Uber. And if you look across Australia, 200,000 Australians indicated that they're using car share services. So car share, rideshare, you know, these apps, these technologies that are evolving, the way everyone's using a car globally, including Australia, is changing as we watch it.
And Mike Ramsey, who's Research Director for Automotive and Smart Mobility at the consulting firm Gartner, says the biggest change from the car maker's perspective is how much we choose to buy them.
It has always been the case that in Sydney or in New York City or in San Francisco or in Tokyo, that owning an automobile is really not even logical if you're in certain areas of those cities, right? The convenience factor is not there. There's public transportation. Parking is expensive and difficult to find. We find other ways to get around. What's happening is the technology is starting to liberate areas that are near there, where it still doesn't make sense to not own a vehicle, but it will soon make sense to maybe consider some other means, because you don't really have to have a car. You have close access to public transportation. You don't really need two vehicles. So what's going to happen is that these mobility services are going to eat around the edges and gradually expand the area where having a car doesn't make sense. I think that in rural areas or far out suburbs, it's pretty likely that people will continue to own cars in the way that they have for a very long time, maybe always. But in the next 20 years, the number of cars that are in your driveway is going to decline. And I don't think that there's anything to stop that, because what the technology in the cars has done is just made it easier to not own a car. And that's really what drives people. It's convenience more than cost.
But what if cost is such a big factor that it changes everything?
We're on the cusp of the fastest, deepest disruption in transportation history.
Tony Sieber lectures at Stanford University. He's also the founder of RethinkX, a think tank that looks at technology-driven disruption.
We expect that by 2030, 95% of U.S. auto miles will be traveled in autonomous electric on-demand vehicles, which means This is a new business model that we call transportation as a service or TaaS, and it's going to have massive implications for the auto industry. No more petrol cars will be sold starting about 2024. The whole concept of individually owned cars is going to be obsolete. Essentially, we're going from individually owned internal combustion engine or ICE petrol cars to fleets, think Uber, electric, autonomous. And what that's going to deliver is a cost per mile that's going to be up to 10 times cheaper than buying a new car, 10 times cheaper. Every time in history where a new product or service has been equivalent to the incumbent, has been 10 times cheaper, that's a 10x, there has been a disruption every single time in history.
So how will it be 10 times cheaper?
We spend about $10,000 per year in car ownership. And with on-demand transportation, essentially we save up to 90%. So when you go in, say, 2021 to buy a new car, the decision is going to be, do I want to spend $50,000 over the next 5 years in owning a car, or do I want to spend $5,000 and on demand? Essentially, I don't have to pay anything now. I only use it when I need it. That $45,000 savings is going to be a no-brainer. Essentially, it's the rational economic choice. It's going to be such a massive portion of what the middle class makes that essentially they're going to make that decision, because throughout history, that 10x has been a marker of a decision that they've made. And things that are status symbols or cultural indicators or signaling, there are going to be other signals.
But Tony, we're not rational about cars. They do say something about us, and we think of them as personal spaces. We're emotional about them.
Correct. If you talk about a 20 or 30% difference in savings, then I would not be talking to you, because that's what we have today. We're willing to pay 20, 30, 40% more for a product because of the brand, for a BMW, for a Porsche, and so on and so forth. However, again, a 10x difference in cost has always implied, and I've only studied disruptions back to 1454. And every single time that you've seen a 10x difference in cost, you've seen a disruption. So that overwhelms the small emotional attachment that we get with the brand, which essentially means 20, 30%.
Tony Sieber's not arguing that the privately owned car will disappear. It just won't be important.
We find that by 2030, 40% of the cars that are going to be still on the road are going to be individually owned. So we still assume that there's going to be a large number, percent of the population, whether it's because they don't care about the money, whether it's because they're technophobes, or because they're in rural areas, far rural areas, essentially they're going to still own their automobiles, 40%. But even then, because they're going to be individually owned, that 40% is only going to contribute 5% of the miles traveled, whereas because we only use cars 4% of the time. When you have an Uber or Lyft or a Didi driving around, they're going to be driving 40% of the time. That means that they're going to be driving 100,000 miles per year, each car, as opposed to 10,000 for each individual. So even though these companies, these fleets, are going to be only 60% of the then existing cars, they're going to contribute 95% of the miles. That's why we say 95% of the miles are going to be electric and autonomous, because they're going to be driving 100,000 miles per year. They're not going to park, essentially. They're only going to park when they need to park for charging or picking up people and goods and so on. Today, we park our cars 96% of the time.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're looking at the economics of the car. Tony Sieber believes the industry's about to change completely, and part of that will be that cars are powered by electric motors. Certainly, at the Frankfurt Motor Show last week, electrics were big. But are we seeing the end of the internal combustion engine? Mike Ramsey.
I would say that the internal combustion engine right now is not on its deathbed, but it is certainly the beginning of the end. How's that? It's how, I don't know how long the end will be. It may be 30 or 40 years, but there's a lot of things moving that direction. It's the fact that eventually, you know, the fuel that goes into it is going to become more scarce and difficult to get, and the prices will go up. Right now we have had a really unusual period of flat fuel prices or low fuel prices. That won't last forever. We know that, you know, so then there's a lot of pressure around the world to move to this new energy, which has a lot of advantages. It's, you know, it's fungible. It can be produced by all these different sources. It can be stored. It's clean. All those things are combining to lead in that direction. But what you're going to see in the near term is the electrification of cars, where batteries are going to start to appear in cars beyond just the starter motor, you know, and those batteries are going to assist and reduce the fuel consumption. And over time, they'll either become larger and take up more of the propulsion, or the car's just going to become electric altogether.
As of now, Australia's not exactly embracing electric vehicles.
What we are seeing is a growing number of the hybrid vehicles, the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, or PHEVs, as we like to call them in the trade. And I guess that's an attempt by people to make that step in the direction of electric vehicles, which, you know, we know is the future direction of the industry, but still having that safe backup of a fuel option if they need it. You know, range anxiety in electric vehicles is a real thing. When I've written about electric vehicles in the past, what people respond with are concerns about cost, the fact that they are still a bit of a luxury item at the higher end of the price bracket, but also, you know, the ability to take long trips and access charge points along the way, and also the time that it might take to charge up a vehicle. You can fill your fuel tank in 5 or 10 minutes, but to really charge a battery up from a low point, it can take, you know, an hour or longer at the moment.
All right, that's where we are with electrics. What about the next part of Tony Sieber's predicted disruption? Autonomous vehicles.
There's multiple trials across Australia. Here in New South Wales, out at Olympic Park, they're doing a 2-year trial of a fully autonomous driverless shuttle bus with Navya. Adelaide is also looking heavily at that. In fact, Navya is planning to build them in Adelaide. Although manufacturing, unfortunately, is leaving, there are elements of sort of new industries of manufacturing potentially moving in. Victoria is looking, EastConnect, CityLink, they're doing trials looking at how autonomous vehicles interact with road signs, lane markings, signalized intersections. So I think Australia is, rightly so, looking at how this technology interacts with our drivers, interacts with our environments. And it's a space where we should be competitive. I mean, Australians are an innovative culture. Google Maps started here. SCATS, the software that runs signalized intersections that sold many places around the world, was designed here in the 70s.
Whether we end up making autonomous cars, the consensus is that we will end up riding in them.
I think the implications for autonomous cars in terms of how they'll affect things like road rules and privacy and insurance liability and legislative changes are an area that is rapidly evolving, and I think it's an exciting time to be involved in this area. Certainly, it's fascinating to think that right now we say that people learning to drive today may never drive a manual car, which is remarkable. You know, to those of us who grew up driving manual cars, what we're looking at now is that babies born today may never drive a vehicle at all. Those babies born today will become teenagers who will step into an autonomous car when they come of age. And I think the fascinating thing for me is to think about what sorts of opportunities open up when you no longer need to keep your eyes on the road. How does that change the way we design vehicles, and how does that change our driving experience?
Well, it might make it a bit less crashy.
Immediate benefits are definitely potentially safety. We as humans, you know, there is human error, and that causes a lot of loss of life. But also efficiencies. You know, some studies have shown maybe in some situations double or maybe even up to triple the throughput through intersections or some congested areas, which has a massive potential congestion benefit. But then the most interesting thing is how will we respond to them in terms of land usage and urban sprawl? If I can sleep in my car on my way to work, maybe I'll live 2 hours away. And that has very interesting city planning ramifications. And I think these are some of the issues that we're only now really starting to think through, and nobody knows the answer to quite yet, but we need to be thinking through them. And that's one reason why these trials and seeing how do people respond to them, how do they function, how do they fit into people's lives, these are very important questions.
Whoa, back up to the intersections bit. Are you imagining that we could do without traffic lights?
You know, still have some intersection infrastructure where the vehicles sort of, you know, schedule their flight plans in a way, or potentially in some areas, vehicles negotiate between themselves without any infrastructure whatsoever. And it looks a bit scary at first because the vehicles sort of reserve their trajectory through the intersection and you might go right by someone else going in a different way. But that's where, you know, the technology that can respond in milliseconds. I mean, as humans, we have a perception reaction time probably of about 2 seconds, give or take, which if you're traveling, you know, 30 kilometers is you know, not that much. You know, the space that you would need to be able to react is quite significant. So, but if you have technology that can respond in milliseconds or better, you can actually put vehicles quite close, even at higher speeds, and still be safe. And that leads to a tremendous potential improvement in the throughput and efficiency and therefore the reliability of trips.
At the moment, we are not comfortable with this idea, as Gartner discovered when it did a big survey in Germany and the US.
I guess I wasn't really surprised to see that, but, you know, when you dig into the information and you ask them then why, right, afterwards, 55% of people flat out said that they wouldn't even consider riding in an autonomous vehicle. But a higher percentage, about 71% of people, said they would ride in a vehicle where it would drive some of the time, but they could still take control of the vehicle. What really scares people is that inability to take control if they feel like the machine is doing it right. So to me, you know, what this says is that, you know, it's not uncommon to be afraid of the unknown, of especially of a technology that has your life in its hands, so to speak. But also, it's a user interface challenge. How do you make it so that you can communicate with the machine? So you may not be driving, but you can still tell the machine what to do. Because if you can't take control when something strange is happening, or even something mundane, like if it's a cab, how many times have you been in a cab where you just said to the driver, just drop me off here, not to the destination? Well, you know, can you communicate that to a robot? How can you do that? I mean, is that interface there for you to do that? So I think that those kind of fears are what drive people's anxiety about using that. And if manufacturers are able to show that they can overcome that, my guess is that you'll see, you know, people willing to sign up for it, especially in an urban context, because it, you know, you can do other things and it's safe and, you know, you can enjoy yourself in the car.
Okay, so autonomous cars are coming. What about the third part of Tony Sieber's disruption, the bit that affects car ownership? Jane Speechley.
Most forecasts these days seem to suggest that we will be looking at driving or car ownership as a service. And that's both on an individual basis, as far as, you know, I as an individual being able to call a car to my doorstep and have it take me autonomously to where I want to go. But there's also big implications there for public transport, of course, and governments and the private sector finding a way to transport large groups of people without the need for a driver as such. And I think then some people are suggesting that the idea of this individual car ownership will become this sort of luxury premium item, and that then has implications for the types of vehicles we're driving and how they're designed as well.
And this isn't just in the future. It's happening now.
It's already changing a bit. You know, I mentioned earlier some of the stats on car share and ride share, and the concept of ownership already is shifting some, but I think it's moving towards, again, that long tail, that market segmentation, where people are able to pick the solutions that fit into their lives. Instead of saying, here's one solution, everyone has to take it, and that's what's going to work, you're going to own a car no matter what, we can now say, well, maybe that makes sense for me, or maybe it makes sense instead to use it as a service. Or maybe instead of the family owning two cars, we own one, and then we top it up with a car share or a ride share. That's looking like a very likely outcome.
On the Money today, the changing economics of cars. As you've been hearing, we'll be transitioning to electric-powered, autonomous vehicles that we mostly won't own. Tony Sieber from Rethink X says you and I will only be paying a tenth of what we do now for the same amount of utility, and it's going to have a massive impact on two enormous industries.
When you include oil and transportation together, they are $10 trillion a year. 10 trillion miles, $10 trillion, that's about $1 a mile. So that $10 trillion is going to shrink by about 75 to 80%, essentially, by 2030, which means this, the fleet of cars on the road that we're going to need is going to shrink by 80%. We're going to need 80% fewer cars to deliver 50% more miles, which means that the number of cars that are going to be demanded by the market is going to shrink by 70%. So think about the automakers that exist today. That market is going to shrink by 70%. And on top of that, you see new entrants coming into the industry, BYD and Fisker and Tesla and so on, computer companies, Uber, Google and Apple and so on, that are entering the industry. So the auto industry is going to shrink by 70%, and new entrants, computer companies essentially, are coming in. So the auto industry is going to face an existential crisis within a couple of years.
Blimey. What about oil?
Assuming that autonomous vehicles are ready, technically, and approved by the regulators 2021, that means that the oil industry is going to peak at 100 million barrels per day, 2020, the year 2020, and it's going to shrink to 70 million barrels per day by 2030. So within 10 years, the industry volume is going to shrink by about 30%, which is going to be the first time in history. This is going to have dramatic effects around the world. The biggest one, though, is that pricing is going to collapse immediately. So one of the things that we learned in 2014 is that all you need for the price of oil to collapse is an oversupply of 2 million barrels per day. That's only 2% of the total supply because of the inelasticity of demand and supply. And we see an oversupply far larger than 2 million barrels per day starting 2021. And what that implies is that the price of oil, the equilibrium price, is going to crash to about $25 per barrel. So volume is going to collapse over a decade, but price is going to collapse immediately, which means this: anyone as soon as 2021 or 2022 that cannot sell oil in the world market at 20 or 25 is essentially going to be bankrupt.
But hang on, Tony. You're talking about big industries with deep pockets and a lot of lobbying power. They're not just going to roll over and let this happen.
Yes, and they are fighting very hard. The difference this time is that essentially the interest of the auto industry are not aligned with the interests of the oil industry anymore. So you're going to have the oil industry on one side, but they're going to be fighting the auto industry, which used to be its allies. Also, they're going to be fighting the technology industry. And if you look at the wealthiest companies in the world by market valuation, it's Apple, it's Google, it's companies that are entering the auto industry. So the oil industry is not just fighting little startup companies in Silicon Valley. They're fighting the auto industry. They're fighting the technology industry, which are larger now than the oil industry. And they're also fighting the demographics that are going to benefit from the disruption of transportation, the demographics that are going to, for the first time ever, have access to very cheap on-demand transportation, such as the elderly, the pensioner, the young, and the disabled. All of these groups are also going to be aligned on the side of autonomous and electric vehicles.
Tony Sieber's report was published a few months ago. It's put a rocket up the auto and energy industries. But predicting the future is notoriously difficult, and it's harder the further out you go. So what about a shorter time frame, say 5 years from now, in 2022? Jane Speechley.
What we certainly are seeing become more mainstream now are a lot of those semi-autonomous functions. So they're particularly safety and performance aspects of your vehicle that activate beyond your control. So the lane warnings and the collision warnings and features that will apply the brake and control your car quicker than you might be able to react. And those are definitely in the mainstream now. And we'll keep moving on beyond that, I think.
Travis Waller, what about you? Will our roads look different in 2022?
Yes, they'll already start looking different in terms of vehicle-to-vehicle technology, vehicle-to-infrastructure technology, you know, different aspects of the transport infrastructure talking to one another. And that's really the first step to much of this. I mean, they have to be connected. They have to be speaking and getting data to be able to lay any of that groundwork for the future technology. And I think those things are starting to come in line.
And these changes, which will come in gradually, will all add up. Mike Ramsey.
I think that all things in automotive move glacially. You know, when you think about digital technology, it moves very fast. When you're talking about 4,000-pound pieces of metal that take 4 or 5 years to develop, that cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars new and that people keep for decades, it's very hard to have a radical change quickly. However, the beginnings have already begun. You know, so we're already in the beginning of this. So that change in body style, in purchase behavior, all this stuff is happening now. It's just happening so far on the fringes that it's hard to see it in most people's daily lives. But I guarantee you that in 10 years, we'll look back and say, wow, do you remember when nobody did this? Or do you remember when nobody did that? And that there will start to be a dramatic change. So I really think that the next decade, it's not going to happen overnight, but it'll be dribs and drabs, and 10 years later, you'll look back and be surprised at how much has happened.
Thanks to Mike Ramsey, Research Director of Automotive and Smart Mobility at Gartner, Professor Travis Waller, who heads the Research Centre for Integrated Transport Innovation at the University of New South Wales, Jane Speechley, writer at Practical Motoring, and Tony Sieber, founder of the Rethink X think tank in California. You'll find more information on our homepage at abc.net.au/rn. The Money is produced by Kate Pearcey. Our sound engineer this week is Martin Peralta. I'm Richard Ailey. Ooh, you might not ever get rich. But let me tell you, it's better than digging a ditch. There ain't no telling who you might be. A movie star, or maybe even a...